Sure. So, everyone, welcome. Thank you for coming on our quarterly or so call of the Network Policy Committee to update folks and solicit feedback on what's happening in the policy world of after school. I think we're going to kind of have about, five parts to this. First, policy, state policy bill updates, because we last met in July, so bills either lived or died since then. Secondly, administrative update for state things coming out of CDE. Third, special focus on the 21st century RFA that many of you are probably busily filling out. Fourth, a federal update, and I know that we have Donica from the Penn Hill Group was going to be on the call probably around 2:20, and I was going to turn to her then. Do I have someone from After School Alliance on the call as well? Okay, there's a chance that we'll also have someone from the Alliance. And then fifth, a regional lead update, which Mary Jo will kind of go through a number of issues that have been raised among regional lead. And I may hit a couple of the ones she intended earlier on. I apologize in advance. But we don't want to save all the good stuff till the end, Mary Jo. So does that sound fine, everybody? Anybody have any other things that they'd like to see added? Okay. Well, we'll just move ahead. So on the bill updates, as I mentioned, bill deadline to get things to the governor was in September, and he had until middle of October to decide what to sign and what to veto. There were three bills that made it to his desk that related in some way to after school, two of which got vetoed, one of which got signed. The vetoed ones were Senate Bill 737, which was going to be doing some things about clarifying who's exempt from child care licensing restrictions and a number of things related to the definition of an organized day camp. What was specifically related to the state after-school program was that it would have changed the maximum number of hours you can operate and still be exempt from child care licensing from 30 hours to 60 hours. And it got vetoed on unrelated grounds related to the rest of the bill. So the it remains that if you operate more than 30 hours in an ACES or 21st century program, you may be subject to child care licensing restrictions. The second is Assembly Bill 165, and this was a bill to put some meat onto a Supreme Court decision from many decades ago, which said that you cannot charge fees for educational activities, inclusive of extracurricular activities. And we know that many ACES programs charge fees, sometimes to increase quality, sometimes to increase the number of students who are served. I think probably the vast majority of them do not charge any fees. There's nothing official on that. So there was concern, since that applied to extracurricular activities, that might apply to the ACES program, and then the places that rely on fees would be in trouble. So two notes on that. Number one, we did talk with the department, who preliminarily said that if it did pass, they thought that after school would still be exempt from that because there's some implicit statutory language suggesting that fees are statutorily authorized, and that would be an exception to the bill. But then secondly, the governor vetoed it. So we don't even have to get there to see if that preliminary interpretation was a final interpretation. So those were the two bills that were vetoed. The third bill that passed was Senate Bill 429, and that's a bill that was sponsored by the Superintendent Torlakson, by the Partnership for Children and Youth, and by Children Now. And it related to supplemental grants that often are used for summer school, summer programming, sometimes used for intercession programs. And what it did was add flexibility in three ways. And it will add flexibility in three ways because it was signed. As I mentioned, those three ways, and we've probably seen it before. Number one was instead of $7.50 a day for three-hour programs, would allow programs to operate six-hour programs for $15 a day for the same amount of money, so that instead of operating like 12 weeks, they'd operate for 6 weeks because they wouldn't get any additional funding, but they could do it, use it in a different way. Secondly, they would allow programs to serve any student in the district while giving priority to students from that particular school. And third, would allow programs to operate on a separate site from the site where the base after-school grant is, be it off the school site or an alternative school site. So those are the three that will be kicking in as of January 1st. And one thing that has kind of come out around this is, as people have kind of looked at these more closely, an understanding that may not have been explicit as this was being considered, that the combination of those final two, the any student in the district and you can move it to a different site, that that leads to a flexibility unlike something that we have in, by and large, in after school, in base grants, that conceivably if you had, say, 16 supplemental grants in a district, you could consolidate those grants into four sites, provided everyone in the district could participate in them, and you could have bigger programs at those sites. So that'll be something that we will wait and see. I think that seems to be a pretty good interpretation of it, but I think that it'll have to be some discussion with the department to make sure that they, in the end, are in agreement on that, because they haven't allowed exactly that in the after-school based grants, and it doesn't expressly say anything about multiple sites being consolidated, but it is an operation of the language that's there. So it's an exciting additional flexibility that seems likely. Any questions about those bill updates?
Brian, this is Mary Jo. And the department has allowed in the past sites to do that consolidation with their supplemental grants.
Oh, they have with the supplemental grants before, but okay.
Yes.
That's helpful to know, even without prior language along that lines.
Yes, because it's just considered off-site from the campus originally awarded the money.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see what I'm saying? So I'll give you an example. A district that has 11 sites, they had supplemental. They ran summer program at just four, and they brought mm-hmm. all the kids to one of those four sites.
Yeah, that's been done quite often. It's been a matter of keeping the attendance separate for each site that was a head recording site, then being consolidated in their operations. So recording uh-huh. attendance from each site back to the core site.
Great. Who is this speaking?
That's Joe Hudson.
Hi.
How you doing?
Good. Well, that's nice to know that that flexibility already exists, and I guess as it becomes more statutorily established, maybe more folks will be open to will consider doing it. Okay, good. Any other questions? Thank you for that input, Mary Jo. Any other and Joe? Any other questions about those or any other bills? Okay, we'll move on to an administrative update. One issue that was still up in the air a little bit when we last spoke but got resolved soon afterwards was the issue of mandatory attendance minimum requirements and the audit guide. And that related to the fact that there's the intent language in the statute that says that elementary school students should attend 5 days and that middle school students should attend at least three days. But there was concern that some auditors were viewing that as a mandate and making programs discount students who attended less than five for elementary or less than three for middle. And that was raised as people were concerned that was not consistent with the statute that pretty clearly said just it was the intent of the 5 and the 3 days and not a mandate. And in the end, and there was some conflict with the Department of Finance that wanted to have a stricter interpretation, and the Department of Education that wanted to have the intent, not mandate. In the end, the Department of Education did seem to get the more flexible interpretation, so that now the audit guide no longer explicitly talks anything about the number of, you know, the minimum number of days in a week that a student attends. So that seems like that issue has been resolved, we hope. The second issue is still close to resolve. We've been hearing this for a long time, is the famous weekends issue about whether or not programs can operate on weekends, and, you know, not counting that for their attendance purposes, but that they, so they can use their state funding for weekend activities. And as we know from the history, there have been some different interpretations from the department, but most recently, no, you cannot. There were a couple of bills that tried to reverse that, and they were vetoed by the past governor. Superintendent Torrickson had been the legislator who was trying to overturn that before, and the department decided, with much urging from the field, that that they should, we should allow for people to operate on weekends using the state after-school funding. And we're still waiting for that to be in writing, even though we've heard it presented several times that that is how they've ruled. And we are told there will be a frequently asked question that will address the permissible use of funding for weekend activities. But we are still, I believe, awaiting that language. And the third part of administrative update is, as folks probably know, in a reorganization of the Department of Education, they've created a new division of after school. We used to be part of the learning supports division, and they're expected to hire a new director very soon, hopefully to start by the beginning of the year. There's been interviews for that job. So that kind of shows a new focus on after school that we are hoping for, and you know, expecting, given Superintendent Torlakson's long involvement in this issue, and certainly this is a nice step for concentrating attention on after school. Any questions about any of those administrative updates or other administrative updates, but knowing that we're going to talk about 21st century separately? And I know some of the stuff that Mary Jo will get to in the regional lead update will be inclusive of that. Okay, so then moving on to 21st century, and be forewarned that if Donica from Penn Hill Group comes on, I want to give her a chance to give the federal update, and we may interrupt the discussion of 21st century. But as folks know, 21st century RFA is out there due December 9th, I think. I could be wrong in that, but I think that's about right. And this is more of a question for folks out there. Have there been issues that have arisen in related to 21st century? I know that there's been, and Mary Jo's going to get into this, been some conflicting answers within the department, which we can get into later. It might flow into this conversation. But are there issues that have kind of arisen out of 21st century RFA, thinking, man, next time around, we want to change this, whether it takes working with the administration or it takes a statute? Have any issues arisen for folks?
There's a couple, Brian, that I think are really important in terms of kind of lessons learned next time around. And that is that three things that I can think of off the top of my head. One is checking the consistency of the RFA, mm-hmm. that they need to have regional leads or someone else outside of the department to read the RFAs before they issue them. There is a major error in the 21st century elementary middle, and if everybody in the field caught it right away. And the second lesson learned is that there has got to be an FAQ process, because it takes them so long to do an errata that by the time the erratas get up, it's too late and people could make wrong decisions not having adequate information. So the ability for perhaps them using the network to pose questions and the answers that come up as they come up, which would then also take care of this consistent question. The third is that they took a lot of things out of the RFA this year and are putting them into a resource guide. The in one webinar, we were told the resource guide would be ready last Friday. No one in the department had a status update last Friday, but many things, particularly that new grantees need to know, is in that resource guide, and that all the materials need to be ready at the time they release it. And the last is that they need to make sure that they've checked their systems capabilities ahead of time. There's two major problems right now. LEAs can't submit more than one application, and two, the grant calculators are not working. And there is some talk from the field that if they can't get this LEA being able to submit more than one application, the latest word I had last Friday is that it would be fixed by November 18th. But that is a problem because people, many districts are closed a week of Thanksgiving. So people were asking if they were going to extend the deadline date. And there was nothing as of this point from the department on that.
Great. Before getting into more, Annette, thank you for laying that out so effectively, Mary Jo. Did Donica from the Pennhill Group come on?
Yep, I am here.
Great.
Great. So, Donica, I told folks in advance that we would let you jump in so that you can do
okay.
The federal update, and then we'll kind of go back to this. So why don't you just tell us what's happening with the federal-related after school?
Sounds good. Hi, everybody. I wanted to sort of break this into some policy updates and then some appropriations updates. For the first time after all this talk, there's actually been a little movement on reauthorizing ESCA, which includes the 21st Century Community Learning Center program. The Senate, it was last week, two weeks ago, marked up in the committee, which is chaired by Senator Harkin and the ranking Republican is Senator Enzi from Wyoming. They marked up the bill, and it passed with some bipartisan support, with Senator Enzi, Alexander, and Kirk. So it's Enzi from Wyoming, Alexander from Tennessee, and Kirk from Illinois voting for it. The rest of the Republicans voted against it. There was a White House amendment to the 21st Century Program that is Senator Whitehouse is from Rhode Island that some of your folks, Jennifer Peck, helped work on. The underlying 21st Century Program that the chairman put forward in the bill is a fairly dramatic change from current law, and the biggest change is that it allows 21st Century funds for the first time to be used for in-school activities. So right now it says it's all for after-school. Whoever provides it, it's for after-school. Now it can be for after-school or in-school. And so that obviously is a big opening for the expanded learning time notion. And that is something that Chairman Harkin is committed to having in there, some sort of ELT type of allowance. And what the strategy was with Senator Whitehouse was to really work on how do we make that workable for our communities? So one of the things that before the markup we were able to do was to ensure that there would be choice. So local communities could choose whether they wanted to have an after-school summer or expanded learning time program. That was very important. In the White House amendment, some additional things were done to make sure, to take another step forward to make sure that it was good for a lot of more folks. One of the things that they did is the White House amendment ensured that there was no federal preference or priority on any one of the approaches, so the Secretary of Education couldn't say, okay, states, when you do your 21st Century program, you have to spend 90% of your funds on ELT only, for example. They cannot do that. The feds have to allow states to run competitions that are local choice. The second thing is that it strengthened the language about community partners. So now they had language that required community partnerships, which we worked very hard to get, but they had sort of a generic opt-out that districts could say, oh, there's no community partners available, so we're not going to partner with them. Instead, this now has a very narrow opt-out, which is only for rural communities and only if they can prove that there's significant hardship in finding a partner. The third thing that we changed is that there's clarity that both the district or the community partner can be the fiscal agent. So who applies is can be either party. And then the last is that there was a small change that Senator Whitehouse's amendment made that that ensured that it wasn't, at least in the basic plan requirements, that programs that were innovative, that were sort of new, could be eligible. That was sort of evidenced by they had a very strict research-based evidence-only program requirement, and it was changed to say programs that you've used research-based strategies, which is a significant shift. There's still the overall program keeps the basic structure that we have now, which is state formula, state to local competitive. It keeps a lot of the same sort of language about what kinds of activities you can do. There's some changing here and there on the details. But so folks like Jennifer Peck, who worked on this, felt that this was a good step in the right direction, but there's still issues to be addressed. Some of them are how they define expanded learning time, and that that we want to make sure that they also set a priority in there for research-based programs that have evidence of research-based, and that priority could be an issue if it ends up preferencing programs that have, you know, 20 years of research behind them and doesn't allow some of the more localized innovative programs to happen. So we're going to be working on some of those issues going forward. Where this bill stands now is that it has passed the committee. The Senate floor has not set a time schedule which it will consider it. It has to go from the committee to the floor and then to conference with the House bill, which I'll talk about in a minute. We don't know what that schedule will look like. So I think information, education, outreach is going to be done to sort of continue the message that we need to continue to improve this program, but thank you for keeping the program. The House has not acted on ESEA yet as a whole. It has done a couple small bills, a flexibility bill, and a bill to eliminate a bunch of programs, not 21st century, but other programs. And it has yet to tackle sort of the big meat of ESEA, like Title I, the teacher, Title II is just teachers, and 21st century and some of these other programs. What we think is going to happen, however, is that the House committee, which is chaired by Republican Congressman Klein from Minnesota, is going to, for all practical purposes, eliminate the 21st century program. He'll block grant it in a large pot that'll probably throw everything in there, sort of allowable activities. It will dramatically change the 21st century program, and it will no longer be dedicated funding. We don't know that for sure. It's just a little hearing. So part of the big picture strategy here on this policy is you're coming up against, zero in the House for 21st century and a changed program. And the strategy to date has been we need to work with the people trying to keep the 21st century program in the Senate, make it better, but not fight against. We have to acknowledge that they want some changes in there in order to keep our champions for the program overall. When we go to conference with the House, if there's no 21st century program in the House, we need to have people fighting to keep this program. So that's where we are. I think in the sort of crystal ball land, it still seems very unlikely that a final ESEA will go to the president this year. I mean, it is very unlikely this calendar year. Next year, if it's not done by June, then you're into the presidential election cycle, and it's pretty much guaranteed not to happen before the next cycle, which would start in 2013. But we're all going to be working very hard to try to get our messages out, try to keep the program, and try not to let this, even if the bill doesn't happen, we don't want to lose momentum in 21st century itself. The other sort of things trickling around the federal space are, obviously, most of you have heard about this big new waiver authority that the administration has granted. And that, in some ways, is superseding ESDA, because even if ESDA doesn't happen, the states that are granted waivers are going to basically be able to write many of the core elements of ESDA on their own. So 41 states have put in letters of intent to be part of that waiver application. You didn't have, if you put the letter of intent in, it doesn't mean that you can't back out. And if you put it in, if you didn't put one in, it doesn't mean you can't enter in the process later. But we know 41 states have. California did not submit a letter of intent yet. We feel like there's probably going to be a lot of pressure on California from the federal end to apply over time. But there's going to be a round of waivers applied for and granted December and January, and then another round later in the spring, like April, May, June, something like that. The big thing in that space is that there's an optional waiver that allows basically states to check a box, and it says that it will start to use 21st century for ELT purposes. What that looks like is very open-ended. So I think that one of the things for you all to pay attention to in California is if California decides to try to apply for a waiver at whatever point, want to make sure that either they don't check that box so that the 21st century program sort of remains intact as it is, or if they check it, they do ELT the right way with the community partners and with, you know, with things that actually complement what's going on the school day and not just replicating the same things that aren't working, that kind of thing. So that's something to think about and watch very carefully in California as that goes forward. If any of you happen to be part of or applying for I-3 grants, we hear they're going to probably be announced on Wednesday, so keep your eyes and ears open. I don't know if any of you did the innovation grants. So, and the other thing is there's Race to the Top Part 3 applications that will likely be coming out soon, and California would be eligible to apply for that. So I'm not sure where they're going to stand, but that's coming. On the funding side, the appropriations are a big mess here, as they are in most states. But we expect you're going to hear in the newspapers a lot about appropriations bills passing here and there, and they're calling them mini buses. This is the new term of art here. I find these terms hysterical, but the omnibus is what everyone talks about when they sort of take all these different funding bills from education, labor, health, justice, defense, and they just put them in one big package at the end of the year and they sign it. That becomes law. So instead of an omnibus, which is all of them, they're doing minibuses, which they're piecing out, you know, three or four at a time. So agriculture, commerce, justice, state, and transportation, housing, and urban development just got passed by the Senate as one little package, one mini bus package. That is how we're going to see a lot of activity this fall, is the Senate and maybe the House are going to pass bits and pieces of all the stuff. But at the end of the day, it's still going to be some big negotiated deal. We're living under a continuing resolution right now based on last year's levels. And no, we don't know yet, but the two things that could happen is, one is we could have some big deal that happens and there's funding cuts and funding increases and all of that at the end of the day, or they just get into a stalemate and they have a continuing resolution for the rest of the year that just has a smaller across-the-board cut in it. Education is not likely to see massive increases in any scenario. It's just not a place. It hopefully will be protected from massive cuts because of its importance in the political scene. But it is not like these two massive increases. That's not just 21st century, but that's a lot of other things, too. That's kind of my update. I'm happy to answer any questions if anybody has them.
This is Brian. Thank you for that. Two quick questions. One, both related to the White House amendment. I know you said how the federal government's not allowed to have a preference or a priority. Are the states allowed to, or is it explicit about that?
So right now, so the original amendment that some of your partners had been backing restricted feds and states from setting a priority for one or the other options. In the White House amendment, the only way they were going to get it accepted if it had only protecting federal priority. So the state one is open-ended right now, and the reason for that is not really about 21st century or ELT. It's about this larger shift in policy going on, which is states can do everything right. It's sort of, you know, if some people see the NCLB, you know, era as heavy fed, and there was a lot of pushback, oh, we want sort of local flexibility type of thing. And now it's sort of settled in that the states are the ones who are going to drive the reform and drive the notion. So they're really protecting state rights. That's one piece that we're going to still work on. We're not sure how it's going to come out in the end of the day, but it was sort of White House felt, well, if we can at least get the federal restriction, that's a start.
Great. And the second question is a little unclear about the status of the stuff about research-based. It sounds like there were some changes made in that, and then Jennifer and others are still interested in further changes.
Sorry.
Is
yep.
that the status?
So the way they sort of set this up is they had two areas where the research-based evidence criteria was important. One was a general programmatic application requirement. So anyone who's going to be eligible for 21st century grants locally has to, at the time, say that they have evidence of a research-based program. Then they also set priorities for the application. So, you know, in the states, they would have points awarded on top of the regular points for certain things. One of those things was good. It was the strength of the community partners, community school partnership. Another thing was this evidence of research-based. Where we were able to sort of fix the notion of evidence of research-based and the basic eligibility requirements, we were able to say, the White House amendment said, okay, not evidence-based, research-based, but evidence of using research-based strategies, which is a very different thing. So you could be a new model or sort of a locally grown model. You don't have to be a canned model in that instance. Harkin, Senate Chairman Harkin, would not change the priority for White House at this time. And so we're going to still have to sort of try to look at that and see what we can do in the future. But that's the two different pieces.
Thank you. Do others have question? And also, is anyone from the Alliance on the line, Jen or Eric? Okay. Anybody, the California folks on the line, have any further questions for Donica about that pretty comprehensive update?
No, it was a great update. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Great. Last chance for questions. Great. Well, Donica, thank you. We appreciate you taking the time out at the end of your day.
No problem. Yeah, exactly. Okay. Well, take care, everybody.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Okay. Getting back on track. Mary Jo just kind of laid out in four or so issues related to 21st century RFA. I wonder if maybe why don't we just for a couple minutes sort of take questions on those, and then she can get into her broader update on the remaining stuff. But were there any questions about some of those RFA issues that Mary Jo raised? I guess one issue that also I had heard was, and it has something to do with the consistency and not, whether or not one district needs to do multiple applications if they want, you know, should they separate the program improvement schools from others? And I guess this relates to the problem that LEOs, I guess, were kind of told in the end, yes, you should do separate applications, but as Mary Jo pointed out, but now technically since they're not capable of doing that systematically, but trying to fix that. But I know that that raises red flags for some people because it requires doing two applications when they would rather do one, even though they understand that maybe, you know, certain schools have a better shot of getting a grant than others.
Well, Brian, but there's a bigger issue in reading the RFAs. The PI schools will not get the priority points unless all the schools in the app are PI.
Mm-hmm.
And so, therefore, that's why people want to do two separate districts. I mean, two separate apps.
Separate applications.
Yeah.
But also, I think on that part where the RFA states that, the RFA actually contradicts itself from one paragraph to the next. So in one paragraph, it basically says you'll get the PI points awarded per site, and then it goes on. But then it goes on basically to say the PI sites have to all be together. So it really kind of threw people for a loop because it was written so poorly that it just was very confusing. But they've clarified quite vehemently that they must be done separately, except for the fact now you have the technical issues.
Yeah, good. Any other questions for Mary Jo on the 21st century? I guess I have one, which you said there was one major error that everyone noticed. Lay it on us. What was it?
The error was that it's actually on page 4, I believe, of the element RFA. It says that an ACES site can apply to get additional slots, but your ACES and 21st century grants together can't exceed the legislative cap. And so in reading it that way, that then makes it appear as if a school, an elementary school, could only get 112 total between the two, and that's absolutely not correct.
Okay. Thank you. Why don't we move on to the rest of the issues that Mary Jo can update us on? And then we'll open it up all. Go ahead.
One other. With the scoring matrix, it doesn't seem to be in past RFAs there was you could look at the scoring matrix and actually see where priorities were given with regards to points and such.
Thank you, Joe. That's the other big issue. The scoring rubric is not available yet.
Yeah, so no one can see where to put their efforts and their focus because there is no scoring rubric. Yeah.
Wow.
So, Brian, I think for this, okay, committee,
yeah,
kind of a short-term thing, and that is that the issue of no scoring rubric yet, the resource guide not being available, the assist system as of right now not being able to take more than one application from an LEA, and the grant calculator, which people need to use for large grant adjustments or school adjustments, are not working. I think the issue comes down to, does this committee want to make a recommendation about delaying the due date? You know, in the past, this committee has done that when there's been other issues.
I mean, I think it's a very good point. I don't know if historically we've actually done much action recommendations as a committee, but I don't think that forecloses because it seems like that there's legitimate concerns being raised. Do you know if there have been any? I think you mentioned that there have been some formal requests from others for.
Well, I did a live webcast last week, and people on the elementary middle, okay. And people ask me, because these things aren't working, are you going to extend? Okay, I don't know that they've asked the state yet. I asked the state today based on all the folks that I had on the phone last week and all the issues that have come up.
And did you do that in writing or just a call, an email?
Of course.
And Mary Jo, I'll be following up, making that same request. We have.
And if you have a sample of what the writing, how you kind of, I mean, you laid this out so well, but you're better versed. If you have, that would be helpful for me. And I can talk.
Yeah, I'll forward it to you right now.
I can
talk
it over with Andy at the network and try to figure out what.
I'll forward it to you right now.
Step.
Send it to me.
Joe, did you have something to add?
No, I said Mary Jo, if you'll send that to me too, I'll hit every point as well.
Okay.
Yeah. I think that only other point that some folks in our region who have from a strong basis of community-based organizations felt also in the competitive priority process that there wasn't really clarity as to how you document that you are submitting the application in partnership. I mean, obviously, you could go through the narrative. In the past, there were like the MOUs for competitive priority where you had to have sign-offs by your people who you were jointly submitting the application in partnership with. This year, it seems almost like it's a checkbox. So I know some people were, some of the folks felt that it wasn't, that it was all being based more on PI, but not giving very much credence to the having a true partnership with another organization.
Yeah, that, I mean, and I do recall in the past, it always felt pretty explicit that there was, that was like one of the highest priorities.
Yeah.
But you're, so you're saying that there's not even like, there's not really a checkbox even to say we are doing this in partnership.
I think that the checkbox. I think we.
There's a checkbox.
There's nothing that describes that priority or.
The issue.
Okay, got it.
The issue, actually, Joe, the issue that where that comes up is it comes back to the scoring rubric.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Okay, because, you know, I don't know that there's been competitive priority points in the past, Joe, but there have been points in the rubric, okay, given for that, and since we don't have the scoring rubric, but on page 47, there's representative sampling of stakeholders. So stakeholder groups must include the signature of those stakeholder groups in this proposal.
Okay.
So those folks do have to sign. And then the other, I'm looking for it while we talk. So there is on 47 a form that they have to sign. And then on page 38, on the cover page, is this application submitted jointly by at least one ELEA and one CBO or other public or private entity? There is a checkbox for yes or no.
Yeah,
but
that's
nowhere on that cover page
does
the CBO or private or public entity, but it does on then page, like I said, on page 40. I did have these pages memorized. On page 47, it is asking for the names of those collaborative members and their signatures.
Yeah.
But what's not clear is how many points, if any, are going to be given to that.
Well, what's clear also, though, is in the general priority for the absolute, for the competitive priority one, the application has to be both from a PI school as well as it has to be done in partnership with a jointly between the LEA and one CBO or other public and private entity. So
well, you know, Joe, I asked that question because of the way that it's written.
Mm-hmm.
I asked Chuck last week about that because I said it makes it seem like it has to be a dual submission.
Yeah.
And the answer is no.
See, now, in the past, you always had to have something really proving it. And
No. In the past, you had to have those letters of those MOUs.
Yeah.
And letters of agreement, and they're still requiring those now. That's what they mean by submission, that it's a partnership.
Yeah.
But it's not two entities applying together.
Yeah, so they're not applying. They're not applying as a collaborative.
No, and they've not in the past.
Mm-hmm.
They've never. I went back to the old ones. They've never applied together, but it's the points that have been awarded for collaboration.
You got points for collaboration, and over here, I guess the. It looks like here though is, you know, obviously. Even if they were going to say, well, this was the part of this that was relevant, is, you know, in fill out form 40 on page 46, you know, that would be nice, but it just is thrown in there with the PI schools, the list of PI schools, and additionally, applications must be submitted jointly. It really didn't give a process, so I think people were confused by that, just by the way it's worded.
Guys, why don't we just
I'm losing you, but that's okay.
Yeah, maybe you guys want to communicate offline for further clarification.
Yeah.
Very insightful, but yeah. So, Mary Jo, do you want to kind of lay out a few of the other issues that have been coming up among regional leads?
Sure. So, and one of the issues that we talked about at the last policy committee meeting was this whole change of fiscal agent. So the department did a survey of regional leads, of grantees, and of consortiums, and they did this in conjunction with SEFESA, and they got a fairly good return back on that survey. They're in the process of drafting what the change of fiscal agency policies and procedures will be moving forward. And what generated this is that there has not been consistent decision-making at the department level about these requests of change of fiscal agents. So as of last week, they were still in the process of drafting that.
Okay.
Second is involuntary reductions. Just to remind people, last year they used data from the last two calendar years as well as the last two fiscal years to determine how they would, what data they would use to make involuntary reductions, and they used the one that would be in the best interest of the grantee. After looking over their data, they have determined that this year they will use the last two calendar years, that it provides the most up-to-date data and is in the best interest of the grantees to use that data. I think we've talked about the 21st century.
So before it was like it was actual.
It was
school.
Well, the law calls for fiscal. The law calls for fiscal.
Yeah.
And last year they used last two fiscal years as well as last two calendar years. But what they've determined is calendar years works best for grantees because it reflects the most up-to-date data. So
yeah,
they will be using July 1st of 10 through December 31st of 11. So it gives credit to those programs who may have struggled 1 year but have been able to turn their programs around.
Okay. So they don't, it's not the full calendar years then that they're using.
Oh, yeah. They're using two full calendar years of data. It crosses over fiscal years.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
And before we say they used a mix. It's originally they used fiscal, but then they used fiscal and calendar, and now they're moving to calendar.
Well, last year they used both, calendar and fiscal.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. New biggie, non-LEAs that have gotten 21st century traditionally had not been put through the CPM process, which is now known as FPM, and they will be piloting with 10 non-LEAs this year the FPM process. And this will be the on-site FPM process, not the online review.
Okay.
And the last is the department is looking for people to participate in the Readers Conference, which is February 13th through the 17th up in Sacramento, because they have been informed by the feds that regional leads and department personnel no longer can be part of the reading process. So that leaves them without folks to do that. And if they cannot get folks from the after-school world to participate in that, they will have to bring in people from other departments who may not know anything about after school.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I think we've covered the other thing, Brian, that I had sent to you.
That seems right. Any questions about any of the issues that the many issues that Mary Jo laid out for us? Okay. Are there other issues that people wanted to raise, either for this time or for future calls? Okay. Well, people should feel free to contact me with questions. I will be putting together a summary that will go out to the full policy committee that you're free to share with anyone. And I will also explore the possibility of having a letter come from either the network or from the chair of the network policy committee regarding extending the deadline for 21st century, given all these fundamental issues. And I take it that there's no dissenters. Anybody who thinks no, we don't need to extend it. And I figure the next call will be after the introduction of the budget in January, so we'll try for something near the end of January, as bills start to also get brainstormed a bit. So last chance for any comments?
I would just say, Brian, that, the only reason we might want to have something earlier is if the new division director starts earlier than the first, that we may just want to have a short call to have that person on the line and just be introduced, at least virtually, to this committee. Just an idea.
I think that's worthy of considering. I mean, I think also we might want to think of how the network wants to, if the network wants to have first crack overall.
Right.
Let's keep our eye on the ball on the timing of that. So it's a good point. I mean, I think we all have several places with different hats on where
yes.
We're all trying to get the ear of that person. So I don't want to just give them another one with the same. I got Mary Jo at the regional lead. I got Brian at the CA3.
Right. Right. No.
It's a good point. I mean, clearly it's an important issue, or development in after school, so worthy of thinking through.
Yeah.
Good. Okay. Well, thank you to all who either participated or are listening online.
Okay,
thanks, Mary
great.
Jo.
Well, thank you for hosting,
great.
Brian, and thanks, Bruno, for being there.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. And Bruno, do you have some sense how many folks we had on the line today?
Not on me right now, but I could give that information after the call is over.
Okay, I'm curious because it's been a pretty quiet.
We'll definitely send you a note, Mary Jo and Brian, and let you know how many folks were on the line.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Great.
Thanks very much.
Hey, good holidays, everybody.